couple of episodes ago on the podcast, we mentioned the death of Peter Bogdanovich, the great filmmaker, the director of The Last Picture Show and Targets and Paper Moon, and, you know, recognizable character actor, friend of Orson Welles and John Ford, a true legend in his time. But it turns out that that was actually not the end of Peter Bogdanovich's story. He still had one last creative offering in the tank before his passing. And he actually made an entire film before his death. I'm reading on Deadline.com this incredible headline that broke just minutes before we recorded. Peter Bogdanovich's Last Picture Show. NFT Lit Project 2 Flux, starring Kim Basinger, set for January 25th release through Ethereum blockchain.
Oh, no.
It says, exclusive. Peter Bogdanovich, who died January 6th at age 82, had one final creative project that just got set for release. Weeks before his death, the disruptive filmmaker. You hear that? The disruptive filmmaker.
Oh, I see what they did.
That's
there.
It's not the word I would use to describe him, frankly, but...
the change-making hashtag rise and grind filmmaker.
I genuinely am hard-pressed to think of a more backwards-looking filmmaker than Peter Bogdanovich, but anyway, the disruptive filmmaker made Lit Project 2... Flux, which stars Kim Basinger in the first NFT collaboration between a legendary director and an Oscar-winning actress, created specifically for and available only on the Ethereum blockchain. So you hear that? Records are being broken every day.
Can you just unpack a bit for the uninitiated? What the hell are we actually talking about here? You're Peter Bogdanovich... You know, the NFT bros got to him when he was at death's door, and he was going to make some kind of movie or something with Kim Basinger that was exclusively going to be available to people who own Ethereum. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. This truly is elder abuse. But it says here, they're quoting Bogdanovich's manager, one Oren Siegel. He said, Peter directed a set of clips with Kim acting out all these emotions, with Peter narrating the clips with his voice. They had extensive conversations about it. It's a new medium, and Peter was really compelled to jump right into it, and now it becomes part of his legacy. So I just want to reiterate, this is a clip. It's probably, I want to say, 2 minutes of Kim Basinger making a number of different faces while you hear Peter Bogdanovich tell her what faces to make, and you can watch that. That's his final film, and you can watch that on the blockchain. I feel like the blockchain is where the stuff that used to be DVD extras now goes to live. That's become the new place for it, or not even extras, where DVD menus now live.
That's the interactive menus that first generation DVDs used to brag about. I'll tell you what I think is so funny about NFTs and blockchain and all that shit is it's so difficult to see. I mean, putting aside the question of whether the technology has some kind of practical application, which, you know, it's quite possible it does. I mean, the actual kind of business strategy of these things, most commodities seek to make a profit by being kind of widely available, right? Mm-hmm. Like, by being something that's useful and desirable that people want, providing a good or service that people want, and then selling it to people. It's very difficult to see what the potential, what the long-term profitability of these, of like creating these new frontiers of commodification that are by definition closed systems that are defined by their exclusivity. And I mean, look, cards on the table, I don't know enough about NFTs and cryptocurrency to say this definitively, but it really does sound to me like classic kind of late stage capitalist dysfunction, the way a lot of venture capital efforts work these days, where all this money is put up front by people who have way too much money, you know, venture capitalists and a certain class of investors. And it's put up front with no kind of expectation that the thing in question is going to become profitable in the short term. This is what's lying behind a lot of the big Silicon Valley boondoggles, whether we're talking about like WeWork or, I mean, honestly, less scandalous things like Uber, which is not profitable. And hell, Netflix loses money every year. The goal of these things is really twofold. One, there is often an underlying belief that if you just kind of power through, you can establish a monopoly on something. Streaming is an obvious example, or you can overpower the local regulations around the taxi industry or something like that, and then you could have a monopoly. And then so at some point in the, you know, hypothetical future, once you've overcome these obstacles, the thing that's not profitable becomes profitable. But the other thing, and this is really the big caveat, is that I think for a lot of investors, I think a lot of them actually implicitly understand that these things are never going to be profitable as business enterprises, because just there's no business model with a lot of these schemes. And I suspect this is true of things like NFTs and cryptocurrency, but there's no actual profitable future for these things as enterprises. But there may be something profitable for you if you're an investor, if you just get out at the right time. Because if enough people sink money into something, then there's a lot of money to be had. And if its value goes up and you own a piece of it, sell that piece of it at the right time and you make a lot of money. I mean, it really is just like a casino. And I can't for the life of me imagine why anybody would want, no offense to the late, great Peter Bogdanovich, but why anyone would want what you just described, or why any investor would want to pour money into that or into a system producing that kind of thing as some kind of long-term venture. And yeah, I suspect it's all bullshit, just like most of these things are.
It just really bothers me on a very fundamental level. It's as if somebody were saying the sky is green when it's actually very visibly blue. If somebody described to you that film that I just described to you and said it's up for free on YouTube, you wouldn't watch it. I wouldn't watch it. Nobody would watch it. And yet,
think how far down a Peter Bogdanovich rabbit hole you'd have to be, how much of a completist you'd have to be to want to watch that.
Yeah, yeah, that person doesn't exist. Anyway, it bothers me, and maybe he was right to die right after. No, I'm just kidding, folks.
This might be a good moment for you to update the listeners about the latest developments in the Rifkin's Festival NFT Discord server, because I gather there's been some, well, Discord in there.
Well, there are a lot of people who think that this is just some bit that I made up, and I swear to God that it's not. If you didn't hear our episode a couple of weeks ago, the new Woody Allen movie, the post-cancellation movie that he made in Europe, Rifkin's Festival, is getting a small theatrical and streaming release in the coming weeks. And some emerging blockchain-affiliated company came along with Rifkin's Festival NFTs that you can get. And they had a Discord, you know, me and a lot of, I think, Michael and us listeners are in there, you know, having fun talking about Mort Rifkin and his enemy Philippe, you know, just expanding the universe of the Rifkin's Festival movie, talking about Mort's philosophy and all that. It's just a great little community that sprung up. I was really troubled to see on January 1st, 2022, the official Twitter account at Rifkin's Fest NFT tweeted, "Due to an increase in projects, we are taking the decision to merge our Rifkin's Festival NFT into the main metaverse entity at DAO movie." That's DAO movie. The concept remains simple: a film festival in the metaverse, which will now not only be limited to one movie, but a variety of media. Now, you can imagine, folks, how upset I was to see this, you know, as somebody who got in on the ground floor when it was just a little mom and pop Rifkin's Festival business.
It is nothing pure. It's like if even the Rifkin's Festival NFT can go corrupted, I mean, nothing is sacred.
So, you know, I was arguing with them on Twitter. Some of the other Rifkin heads were arguing with them on Twitter. Something that I thought was really funny was Jesse Hawken tweeted at them, "You're killing the golden calf. Rifkin's Festival made you the success you are today. Please reconsider." And they replied to him, "We have noted all your feedback and are grateful for the attachment we see for Rifkin's Festival NFTs. We have escalated to the filmmaker. We'll keep you posted." So, folks, keep an eye on this. Keep an eye on this. There is a chance that the man himself, there's a chance that the director of Annie Hall may be seeing these tweets, and somebody's going to have to explain it to him.
I would go as far as saying, I mean, obviously Woody Allen doesn't know what an NFT is, but I don't think he knows what Twitter is either. This is a man who, even in his pre-cancellation phase, was still working on a typewriter.
So anyway, I encourage everyone, I'll put the Twitter account in the show notes. This is not a targeted harassment campaign. What this is I want you to make it clear to DAO Movies and the Rifkin's Festival NFT people how attached you are to Mort Rifkin and the whole Rifkin milieu.
I mean, you call it a milieu, I call it a movement.
It's a lifestyle, really, you know. Rifkin lifestyle. reject modernity, embrace tradition. That's the lesson of Rifkin's Festival, and it's one that I try to live every day. Luke, what have you been thinking about?
Oh, well, moving on from the burgeoning Mort Rifkin trad movement. It's been an incredible week in Biden land, in Democrat world, whatever you want to call it. A real week of the libs having a normal one. I mean, I don't even know how to have a structured discussion about this. Suffice it to say, there was just an unusually high volume of kind of weird and off-kilter things that happened in Democrat world this week. I mean, I can just list off a few. You had these comments from Jen Psaki yesterday at her press conference, which by the time this comes out, I should have a piece up at Jacobin on that. But where she appeared to refer to parts of what's still ostensibly the Biden agenda as bunny rabbits and ice cream. So this has become a bit of a pattern at these press conferences where a reporter will kind of say, you know, why aren't you doing good thing X, or you've abandoned good thing X or Y? You know, do you think things are going well? And then she'll reply kind of sarcastically and derisively. So this is something that happened last month when she was asked about free COVID tests and the possibility of free COVID tests. They ended up doing free COVID tests a few weeks after she dismissed them as impossible. But so, you know, that's one thing. It's in a slightly different category, but as I'm sure you saw today, you know, because there's been this big climb down on voting rights. I mean, I don't even really want to call it a climb down, because I don't even think that they pivoted to voting rights as the sloppy seconds, like rhetorically they pivoted to it as the sloppy seconds after they couldn't get their signature domestic bill through. And then this week, Biden was like, well, I think we might not get it done, which, like, I saw someone comment, the last honest man in politics, which, you know, there's something to that. But so, you know, rhetorically anyway, a lot of Democrats, even centrist ones, have talked about the issue of voting rights, you know, as if it's this issue of cataclysmic importance. And the thing is, it arguably is. I mean, the stuff that's being done by Republicans at the state level, and we did a bonus episode on this a few months ago, but I mean, it really is deeply sinister. You know, the Republican Party, as has been said again and again, is becoming an increasingly, becoming is the wrong word because it's been one for decades, but is growing increasingly illiberal and anti-democratic and authoritarian, and kind of keen to manipulate the institutions of liberal democracy for partisan advantage. But, you know, it's pretty hard to square the rhetoric here from centrist Democrats about the impending demise of democracy, you know, when they're also inviting Dick Cheney to their ridiculous January 6th commemorative event, or whatever it was called, where they were also serenaded by Lin-Manuel Miranda. A lot of this rhetoric, I think, is really propelled by, you know, what does well in fundraising emails and things like that, and also what drives ratings on TV more than it is kind of earnest concern. But so Hillary Clinton tweeted this Martin Luther King quote about the white moderate, which I'm sure you saw, which, like, the chutzpah of Hillary Clinton tweeting that is just off the chart.
I actually kind of like her now. I like her late period.
The brazenness of it. But so, just in further Clinton news, you know, there was this op-ed in the Wall Street Journal this week about how Hillary Clinton should run for the Democrats, you know, in 2024. And, you know, I got in trouble, and actually one of my colleagues at Jacobin also got the same response, derisively tweeting about this story, where people were kind of like, you're falling for clickbait. You know, don't fall for clickbait. And it's like, okay, well, I don't know, it's an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, and I think I'm allowed to make fun of it. I mean, I think it's kind of a pretty low-stakes thing to do. I don't know what the problem is. But then just today, the Politico playbook broke the news that the Clintons are apparently quite earnest considering some kind of political comeback.
I don't see why they wouldn't. I mean, when you look at the 2024 field, if it's Kamala, if it's Pete, if it's second term Biden, I don't know. I actually think she would stand a really good chance at winning that. And if I were a Democrat, I think I would vote for her out of that lineup.
Well, Will is testing the limits of irony here, even on this podcast. But what's incredible, one of the things that's incredible about this Hillary Clinton tweet is that it ends with the words, this is a subtweet. So Hillary Clinton is epically clapping back against Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema here, which is very funny for, among other reasons, that if you read the Politico playbook story from today, Bill, Hillary's, you know, closest political ally, has been on the phone with the White House and has been advising Biden to, you know, pare down his bill even further to try to win these people over. And then also is quoted as saying that, you know, he doesn't know Kyrsten Sinema that well, but he's met her and he really likes mixer. So Kyrsten Sinema is the white moderate of whom MLK spoke, but also, you know, she's a, you know, we talked to her and she's pretty cool.
By the way, speaking of that epic clapback style that you observed in Jen Psaki, have you seen some of Kamala Harris's interviews lately where when people challenge her, she does this thing of kind of like raising her hand and going, now, no, no, I'm going to stop you right there. You know that move that she does? Don't start talking like a Republican. That move. And then she'll follow it with just some like absolutely incomprehensible gibberish.
Well, she had that interview this week. And actually, this wasn't even on my list of things to bring up. So I'm glad you mentioned it because I'd already suppressed it. But she had that interview this week where she said in response to a question, it is time for us to do what we have been doing. And that time is every day. Every day it is time for us to agree that there are things and tools that are available to us to slow this thing down, the thing in question being COVID. And so right now we know we still have a number of people that is in the millions. So, I mean, obviously that's I'm not offering a lot of context to that quote. I mean, in all seriousness, I don't think the context really adds anything. There was a great moment later in the same interview where she's asked about, like, what about the Americans who are having trouble finding COVID tests? And she responded, well, they should Google it. You know, when I can't find a place or a thing, I just type it into Google. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. All these different things all happening in the same week.
But yeah, they're investing a lot into that kind of like epic clapback viral meme style that would have really reached its pinnacle like when Hillary tweeted delete your account in 2016.
Yeah, and I mean, I saw somebody say I think it was of the Jen Psaki comments that, you know, I blame Aaron Sorkin for this. And, you know, there's definitely something to that, you know, and I've been a broken record on this, you know, Aaron Sorkin kind of training a whole generation or multiple generations of, you know, liberals and political staffers the world over to think that every political debate is decided by, like, you know, a snappy or pithy remark. That's how you stop the right, is you highlight their hypocrisy by quoting biblical passages at them or something like that. I mean, in the case of Kamala Harris, it shouldn't be forgotten that her entire strategy in her presidential campaign, her wildly unsuccessful presidential campaign, was predicated on this very thing. She avoided doing the traditional thing where you campaign in the early states that actually decide a lot of the momentum going forward, and instead went for these kind of viral TV moments, which were supposed to create, you know, all this buzz. So, you know, famously when she did that That Girl Was Me thing about Biden and busing, you know, before running as his vice presidential nominee less than a year later. Her campaign had T-shirts ready to go like that evening that said That Girl Was Me. Like, they were trying to turn that into a thing. There was also the moment where she tried to get some slogan going about, like, taking away Donald Trump's Twitter account. Like, I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but the campaign's actual strategy was that she was going to do these, like, epic moments that were going to go viral, and they were going to build a national presidential campaign out of that. But what I would say about the recurrence of this style in the present moment is just, it's really all they have. Like, when all pretense or most pretense that they're going to pass a big and ambitious agenda has been stripped away, all you got is like the libidinal side, the pure id of this type of centrist liberalism. And you see that in a number of ways. I mean, I think one of them is just, yeah, these kind of epic clapbacks, which, you know, I'm sure the right kind of liberal would see that Jen Psaki press conference and think, wow, she really owned that reporter. It's nice to see somebody finally hold the press to account for a change. But I think you also saw it in, I mean, again, I think this has kind of been forgotten, but did you see that statement that I guess the CDC put out just before Christmas, where some official was commenting and was sort of backpatting people who've got vaccines, and then was saying, you know, added to the unvaccinated, you know, you can look forward to a winter of suffering and death or something like that, right? And this was ostensibly, I think, like a nonpartisan official that was giving some kind of health update. I think that too is just an example of, like, when all the artifice is stripped away, like, what's left in the kind of id of the partisan Democrat? It's just like, okay, well, we're not getting a new deal, but at least, like, the bad people will suffer. Like, the ones who watch Fox News, the ones who live in the wrong states, the ones that, you know, voted only 48% for Joe Biden or whatever. It's pretty bleak times right now for American liberalism, and I think you're going to see a mix of kind of the ugly and the absurd come out of this moment as a result. And just one final thing on this, because after that, I think we need one final dose of absurd. But, you know, there was this slew of op-eds, and I already mentioned the Hillary Clinton Wall Street Journal one. There were a few of these, but the other really funny one was by Thomas L. Friedman, the premise of which was basically, you know, American democracy is under, you know, threat because of Trumpism, yada, 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 January 6th, et cetera, et cetera. And that's why America needs to save its democracy by emulating Israel and having a Biden-Liz Cheney unity ticket in 2024.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a classic, you know, Tom Friedman radical centrist bullshit kind of formulation. Like, just an idea that, you know, appears novel to, like, the right kind of dum-dums who, like, still credulously consume Thomas Friedman. I saw someone refer to the idea of a Biden-Liz Cheney ticket as the fever dream of reactionary centrism, which it's pretty hard to improve on that combination of words. But I just absolutely love this. The idea that America's democratic salvation consists in a unity ticket of Joe Biden and Dick Cheney's daughter. I mean, Dick Cheney, a man who came to power quite literally by stealing an election. I mean, the past few years have given me far too many occasions to think about that Tom Lehrer quote about how he had to stop doing satire because it was obsolete after Henry Kissinger was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. But these days, it just feels like we get a Henry Kissinger Nobel Peace Prize almost every day.
By the way, we're doing this sort of a chill bonus episode to make up for the fact that we've been lax on some episodes lately. We didn't have some free episodes during the holidays. We wanted to, you know, give you just a little bit of extra content to help the lonely evenings pass by less lonely.
Yeah, I think I'd put it a little bit differently than Will, but we did need to take a break because folks, podcasters are workers too.
But before we leave you again, I did want to address a subject of great controversy, something that has been really tearing up Michael and Us Nation, and that is episode 299, the one in which we dealt with Love Actually. We have met with a mixed reaction, I think it's fair to say, to that episode. Some people rightly loved it. Others were a little bit disappointed. We would like to go over some of the feedback, maybe revisit Love Actually just a little bit, just toss around some of the ideas that our community has brought up and do proper justice to the movie. Michael and Us listener Tony Mines, who is in fact the one who suggested it, wrote a very thoughtful comment on the episode in the comment thread where he addressed some of his reasons for wanting to talk about it, and I think really provided a perspective that we as North American viewers really didn't have on this particularly British export. Among other things, he writes, "The film isn't bereft of political content. It is pure ideology." Not the best Zizek, sorry. "Love Actually is the purest known manifestation of how British neoliberalism, the original neoliberalism, operates at the interpersonal level. That's why it depicts love through something other than the familiar logics of human experience. Not because the writing is bad, but because it's lying about the human condition from a vantage of capitalist realism. Richard Curtis really is a menace. He's a menace the way that Will Sloan understands Tom Hanks to be a menace, except Curtis has long since successfully finished the project to shape his native reality into his personal image." He goes on to say, "Love Actually is why Corbyn lost. Don't believe me? Ask the woman I canvassed that fateful night who told me, through her own mouth, as though to imply it was connected to her brain, 'Oh, sorry, I wasn't sure, but I'm definitely voting for Boris after the advert.' 'The advert?' I asked, because I'm not James Medway and I don't watch TV. Turns out Boris himself had done an advert where he personally recreates the famous card scene to some effect or other. And this was good cause to let him run the country." I mean, what can I say, Luke? That is pretty troubling. Elsewhere, another commenter, Michael Rowland, noted that Love Actually is a cool Britannia fantasy film that reimagines the UK's position on the global stage. The main plot follows Tony Blair, Hugh Grant, as he stands up to and subsequently severs links with the tyrannical, misogynist American president, Bill Bush. Billy Bob Thornton. In the process, Britain earns back its claim to be great, assuming its rightful role as the superior Western moral superpower. Love Actually is a subliminal expression of guilt, a reflection of the horrors that were soon to come. The fictional Britain, taking the exact opposite course the real Blair took, that is, blindingly following America, is at its core a wish of what could have been." I have to say, these comments are very smart and very thoughtful. Tony, I think, was right to bring up my deep and seething hatred of Tom Hanks, because I think we're dealing with a comparable situation here where Richard Curtis and Tom Hanks really are people who let the dominant ideology of the society they're working in just kind of flow through them. And when ideology is successful, it can be invisible. So I don't know. I see this Richard Curtis project and I see so much scorn directed at it. And I think, yeah, it's bad, but it's no worse than fucking anything else. And I guess you could say that about a lot of Tom Hanks movies, too.
Well, a significant oversight on my part was that I posited as an alternative, as kind of a better Love Actually, the movie Four Weddings and a Funeral, which, of course, has the same writer. Now, have you seen Four Weddings and a Funeral, Will?
I have not. But yes, you're right. That is a Richard Curtis joint, and huge oversight on our part to not make that connection. I do also want to point out that Richard Curtis is the co-creator of Mr. Bean. So, I mean, got to give the man that. He did give us Mr. Bean, the ultimate Briton.
The ultimate symbol of cool Britannia, which incidentally, yeah. We have to do Mr. Bean, the ultimate disaster movie. I loved that movie as a kid.
It would be interesting to attempt an ideological reading of that one, because the plot is that Mr. Bean, like, because it's a movie, it's taken Bean to the next level. And what does that mean? He has to go to America, because America is the next level, right? He may be from the greatest empire to ever conquer the earth, but he still has to go to America.
Well, I want to say I do appreciate a lot of the comments from our listeners on the episode and on the movie. I mean, we don't have time here to go through them all, but a lot of very thoughtful stuff. I mean, one thing I will say is I do think we at least touched on some of these things. I think what Will and I found difficult and kind of challenging about doing Love Actually, I mean, is I think even for kind of a fluffy movie, there really isn't a lot there. So I mean, it's true that you can look at the Hugh Grant, Billy Bob Thornton scene, which has produced the so-called Love Actually moment, which, you know, it's birthed this idiom that whenever British PMs, you know, can be said to have recreated a version of this, you know, it gets referred to that way in the press.
Kind of like the British version of Going Bullworth, which is something that Obama famously said he wanted to do. He wanted to go Bullworth.
But that's pretty self-evident to me, and like, there's really not a lot else there. I mean, I do. We should have talked about Cool Britannia, because it certainly is a Cool Britannia film, and I think people are right to say that it's a wish fulfillment. I think for me, and I mean, you can accuse me, maybe this is an example of my own, you know, extremely online, you know, discourse brain. But I think the perspective I had, and probably the perspective you had as well, I mean, I'm more kind of immersed in British culture than you are. But for me, I really looked at Love Actually through the prism of how it's been received in North America. And so that's why I was keen to talk about the kind of Love Actually, you know, counter discourse, the actually Love Actually is bad kind of stuff.
Folks, you have to understand that in our online circles, Lindy West was a titanic presence. Okay. She moved mountains with her words.
But I guess what I'm getting at is that it just seemed a little bit easy in 2022 to like rip Love Actually apart on this podcast. Although it does seem like in retrospect, that's what people wanted. So I'll just say kind of for the record, if you guys want us to tear something apart, I guess let us know.
Put a dime in the machine and then click the tear apart button.
Well, I think our approach was to sort of treat it as like axiomatically, like, of course it's bad and not much about it works, but you know, like what else might be said about it? But a lot of thoughtful comments.
I'm going to take a counter approach from you. I actually think that they shouldn't tell us what they want. I think they should trust us.
But anyway, a lot of the comments were good, and I appreciated them. I will just say, I mean, I will hold to the claim that Four Weddings and a Funeral is like a much better version of the same kind of film. It is also very much a Cool Britannia film. Also a movie in which Hugh Grant features very prominently. I think very much I don't think it actually came out during the New Labour era. I think it came out before Blair came to power, but very much a product of Britain in the 1990s. The thing that's so amazing about Four Weddings and a Funeral, which I will just repeat, I mean, I think for this sort of film is pretty funny and charming. I mean, I think it's probably about as good as you can make a, you know, romantic comedy or whatever. But the thing that's so amazing about Four Weddings and a Funeral is that all of the lead characters who are all, you know, all part of this group of friends have these radically different class backgrounds. Like there's this insinuation that Hugh Grant, I mean, so Hugh Grant is a grown man. I can't remember the name of his character. I think it's Charles. And he lives with a roommate called Scarlett. And they're just like adults who are like rooming together, but are somehow friends with this guy called Tom. Tom and his sister. And Tom is one of the richest people. He's like the seventh richest man in England or something. And they go to these like lavish weddings. Like in the conceit of the film, it seems like, you know, every weekend someone they know is getting married and is having a, you know, a totally lavish wedding. And the Hugh Grant character is supposed to be, yeah, like this, as the audience surrogate, is supposed to be this kind of, I guess, scruffy British everyman. Like, it's not really clear what he does for a living. And, you know, his roommate Scarlett is just like just has jobs as a clerk or something, or is like a, you know, as like a retail salesperson. And so it very much is like a Cool Britannia film in a very post-Thatcherite way, where it's like Britain is a classless society, right? I mean, social class exists, but, you know, it's kind of been negated by meritocracy or something. And it's like, hey, we're really, no matter how rich or poor any of us are, in a capital owning democracy, you know, we're all the same. I mean, I don't think that's the explicit like thesis of the movie, but I feel like that's very much at least an inadvertent subtext, and maybe that's a subtext of Love Actually too.
I will just say that if folks are looking for a Hugh Grant movie, the one I would recommend is Bitter Moon, which also teaches us that love is all around us.
Right, so you're referring to the Polanski movie, which, among other things, features one of the main characters. He dresses up as like a pig and he gets domed by his girlfriend. Like, the arc of the movie is that they start a very fiery romance, which they perpetuate by getting kinkier and kinkier to the point that they kind of like sexually expend themselves.
British politicians are always talking about having their Love Actually moment, but why are they not talking about having their Bitter Moon moment?
Well, I guess, I mean, one former Tory PM did have a moment that was at least pig adjacent. And, you know, God knows what Boris was up to when he was at Eton in the same class as David Cameron. I love this idea. Let's replace the Love Actually moment with the Bitter Moon moment.
Now watch this drive.